Hey, Allison.
Hey, Max.
What's wrong?
Traffic again.
Oh, no. You got to get used to this whole LA thing.
I know, but guess what?
What?
Because I was a supporter on Patreon, I got to listen to the podcast a whole day early.
Yes.
Driving to Huntington Beach wasn't so bad.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
What level are you at?
Only $5 a podcast.
Oh, fantastic. That's it.
Only $20 a month.
$20 a month from
patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History. I'm Allison.
My name's Max.
This week, I'm going to be talking about Princess Kaululani.
Yes. And I will be talking about Nina Simone.
Ooh, I'm so excited. Yes. All right. Princess Kaululani. There's actually a movie about her coming out, which is how I found out about her. I sent you the trailer.
You did.
You know, you come across amazing women, even just on YouTube. Yeah.
And we thought at first that it was Lily Wokalani, who we've
covered, but it's not.
It's not. It's another princess.
So in honor of Princess Kaululani, I am going to try and pronounce her entire full Hawaiian name.
Uh-huh. God bless.
Here we go. She was born Victoria Kawekua Kaululani Luna Leo Kalanina Filapa Lapa Cleghorn.
Fantastic.
More commonly known as the Barbarian Princess or the Peacock Princess or just Princess Kaululani.
That's a wild swing in either direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, who gave her the nickname the Barbarian Princess? You'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
So Princess Kaululani was born daughter of Princess Miriam Lakelake and Archibald Scott Cleghorn. Okay. She was the last heiress to the Hawaiian throne, and her royal blood came from her mother's side, as Miriam was a descendant of one of the high chiefs, Chief Kepo Kalani,
okay,
which made her also a descendant of Kamehameha the Great.
Mm-hmm.
Kaululani spent her childhood in peace and essentially paradise. I mean, she grew up in Hawaii in Waikiki on the estate, which had a lot of peacocks, and that those were her favorite bird. That's where the Peacock Princess comes in. They were gifted to her by her beloved grandmother, whom she called Auntie or Mama Ruth, and Ruth loved to lavish gifts on the little princess, and they had a very special connection. Kaululani also spent a lot of time with her uncle, King David Kalakua, who took it upon himself to teach her about the old ways of their people and also about diplomacy and the responsibilities of being a ruler. He taught her the same statement that he himself had learned at High Chief's Children's School in Honolulu, which is, quote, "God has made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth in unity and blessedness. God has bestowed certain rights alike on all men, all chiefs, and all people of all lands," end quote. I love it.
I do too.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
These words had a profound and lasting impact on her, on Kaululani. There was some controversy during her uncle's reign, largely just due to overspending, but it was relatively peaceful, and he was the ruler to truly bring Hawaii forward into the modern age. He became the first monarch to travel the globe to meet with other leaders, the first to install electricity in the palace.
Wow.
Kaululani was actually the first one to turn on the first switch for the new streetlights in 1888 when she was 11 years old. However, just prior to this, her mother passed away at the age of 36 after fighting an illness for only 3 weeks. So it was a terrible loss, of course, for the nation and for the young princess.
Yeah, of course.
She was very devastated. She's 11. She's got all this going on. To further her education, there was a special visitor to the island, someone you may have heard of, author Robert Louis Stevenson.
Oh, yeah.
He helped arrange for her to visit England and to travel and to expand her horizons.
Oh,
he became a beloved friend. And before she left, he just wrote her a personal poem. Because who doesn't want a personal poem from Robert Louis Stevenson?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote, "Forth from her land to mine she goes, the island maid, the island rose, light of heart and bright of face, the daughter of a double race. Her islands here in southern sun shall mourn their Kaululani gone, and I, in her dear banyan shade, look vainly for my little maid. But our Scots islands far away shall glitter with unwonted day and cast for once their tempest by to smile in Kualani's eye.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's so beautiful. Aww. So her uncle, the king, gave her permission to travel to England and for Annie, her half-sister, to accompany her. And it was an eye-opening experience for her. Of course, she felt she'd become just a woman of the world. They traveled around London. She loved England. She did, you know, kind of struggle to fit in. She said the English food, or she had trouble getting used to the bland English food, and she wanted the food of her homeland.
Mm-hmm.
After about a year, Annie returned to Hawaii, but Kualani extended her stay. She began to study hard while traveling. She went to different countries. She was raising funds for the underprivileged and becoming very popular in influential social circles. And she made a lot of personal connections, but stated that when she married, it would be for love, not influence or title or money. Right. She could easily have had her pick of well-connected suitors. She wrote to her aunt, the queen, and said, you know, I could have married this enormously rich German count, but I could not care for him. I feel it would be wrong if I married a man I did not love. In December 1891, the princess received the word that her uncle, the king, had passed away. So she sent condolences to her aunt. And though she remained in England, her original 1 year there had turned into four. Her father later joined her in England, eventually taking her to his native Scotland, which she fell in love with Scotland as well. She began, you know, making relationships with people and became a sort of bridge between Hawaiian and Scottish cultures. And even though she loved her time abroad, she remained in constant communication with her aunt back home. And so it was very shocking and upsetting when she received word that the queen had been deposed and the monarchy abrogated. What had happened is her aunt, the queen, had evidently installed a new cabinet and they tried to write a new constitution, which the ministers then refused to sign. So the queen then attempted to take it to the natives, but the citizens assembled and dethroned the queen instead, at which point the government was put in the hands of a council.
Huh.
Kualani was understandably devastated. She was too far away from the situation to do anything. There were lies being spread about her people in print, primarily, of course, in the United States. People were calling them uncivilized, people who were unfit to rule themselves because they couldn't even keep a council together. And so she struggled with the desire to speak to the press because she did not believe that words from a 17-year-old would make any difference, especially when the world perceived her as something different and when they had not even believed the queen.
Right.
Eventually, she did find the strength to speak to an English paper, and she released the following statement. It's a little long, but it's all good, so bear with me. Quote, 4 years ago, at the request of Mr. Thurston, then a Hawaiian cabinet minister, I was sent away to England to be educated privately and fitted to the position which, by the Constitution of Hawaii, I was to inherit. For all those years, I have patiently and in exile striven to fit myself for my return this year to my native country. I am now told that Mr. Thurston will be in Washington asking you to take away my flag and my throne. No one tells me even this officially. Have I done anything wrong that this should be done to me and my people? I am coming to Washington to plead for my throne, my nation, and my flag. Will not the great American people hear me? End quote.
Call him out.
Burn. Yeah, need some ice over there, Mr. Thurston? Need some water? So she set sail for America shortly after, determined to right all of these wrongs that had been done to her and to her country. Her every movement was heavily recorded from the moment she set foot on American soil. And the Americans were very surprised to be greeted by an elegant, educated young woman rather than the barbaric savage, which the papers had been painting her as, quote, the barbarian princess.
Right.
She addressed the press with the following words, quote, 70 years ago, Christian America sent over Christian men and women to give religion and civilization to Hawaii. Today, three of the sons of those missionaries are at your capital asking you to undo their father's work. Who sent them? Who gave them the authority to break the Constitution which they swore they would uphold? Today, I, a poor weak girl with not one of my people with me and all these, quote, Hawaiian statesmen against me, have strength to stand up for the rights of my people. Even now, I can hear their wail in my heart, and it gives me strength and courage, and I am strong. Strong in the faith of God, strong in the knowledge that I am right, strong in the knowledge that the strength of 70 million people who in this free land will hear my cry and will refuse to let their flag cover to dishonor mine.
Yes.
End quote. So she traveled across the U.S. from city to city, addressing the press in this way, often surprising them with her manners and her education. She did, of course, suffer some racist attacks, but she managed to travel to Washington, D.C. and met with President Grover Cleveland, who was very impressed with her and sympathetic to the plight of her people. However, when they presented the issue to Congress, it refused to restore the monarchy.
Of course it did. Oh, Congress not doing something?
Surprise, surprise. She was deeply disappointed, of course, returned to Europe, where she remained for several years. Her health slowly began to deteriorate. And upon hearing of the deaths of her friends, Robert Louis Stevenson and Annie Cleghorn, her condition worsened. She eventually returned to Hawaii, where her health did not improve. She did announce her engagement to a prince and became a citizen of the territory of Hawaii as the annexation took place. Mm-hmm. But she and other members of the royal family wore funeral attire on this day, as she said it was worse than death.
Dang.
She remained in Hawaii until her death of inflammatory rheumatism, which she contracted after being caught in a storm while on horseback riding. Her impact has been long-lasting, particularly in Hawaiian culture. She's been memorialized in art, music, and dance, and continues to be remembered as a heroine who fought for the rights of her people. She also died March 12th, 1899, at the age of 23.
What?
I know.
What?
I know. It's insane.
She did all of that before she was 23?
Bitches get stuff done.
Dang, girl. That's amazing. I think those might be my favorite stories that we do on this podcast.
Right.
You get all the way to the end and be like, by the way.
Only 23.
She's younger than you.
Sorry.
Oh, wow. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
I really do think we need to try harder to go into Hawaii, because I really think that there is a huge history there that is not known by way too many people.
Yes.
Way too many people.
Yes, yes.
Including the fact, and we've covered this before, that Hawaii was stolen from its people.
Just like most of America.
Stolen. That's true. All right. So I'm going to talk about Nina Simone. She was requested for us to do her by my stepmom, Gretchen.
Ooh, nice. So shout out to Gretchen.
And of course, there is a Netflix documentary that just came out about her as well. And it is a fantastic documentary. It is really good. Nina Simone was born Eunice Kathleen Wayman on February 21st, 1933 in Tryon, North Carolina.
Hey!
Heyo! Her mother, Mary Kate Wayman, was a Methodist minister, and her father, John Devine Wayman, was a handyman who moonlighted as a preacher. She took to music at a really early age, learning to play the piano at age 3 and singing in her church's choir. Her mother sometimes worked as a housemaid, and when her employers heard Eunice playing the piano, they arranged for her to study with a pianist named Muriel Mazanovich. Her early musical training was classical piano, music such as Beethoven and Brahms, and apparently Bach is the composer who really got her into playing music. Yeah,
okay,
she loved
Bach,
apparently. And she wanted, at a very early age, she wanted to be recognized as the first African-American concert pianist to be, like, really successful. Her music teacher helped establish a fund to help pay for Simone's education. And after she finished high school, that fund was used to send her to Juilliard in New York City.
What?
So she did have to work her way through school because, again, the fund was there, but it wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. She taught piano and worked as an accompanist, but eventually she ran out of money and actually had to leave Juilliard, unfortunately, only after about a year and a half. Mm. She moved to Philadelphia with her family so that she could also go to a more affordable music program. Mm-hmm. However, she was rejected by the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, and she later claimed it was because she was African American. She said, "I know I'm good enough."
I mean, she got into Juilliard, so you're not wrong.
Exactly. She started to play in clubs because she needed to make money somehow to support her family in Atlantic City in the 50s, and her interests turned to jazz, blues, and folk music.
Mm.
And the club that she was playing in, the owner said, "If you're not going to sing, you can't play here anymore." So that's what started her singing.
Whoa!
So the very next day she started singing, and it's also the time when she changed her name to Nina Simone, because she didn't want her mother knowing that she was working in clubs playing, quote, the devil's music.
That is my favorite part of the story so far. Please keep going.
So the name Nina was derived from the Spanish word niña, which came from a nickname from her then boyfriend. And Simone was inspired by the French actress Simone Signoret.
Ooh, we haven't done her yet. We've done the other French activist named Simone.
Mm-hmm. We should put her on our list of women to do.
Yes, we should. Yes.
While performing in these clubs, she gained fans such as Langston Hughes, Lorraine Hansberry, and James Baldwin. And she actually became a headliner at nightclubs all along the East Coast, culminating in an appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Wow!
Huge, huge audience. In 1957, she caught the attention of Sid Nathan, who was the owner of the blues and country label King Records, and offered Simone a contract with his jazz subsidiary, Bethlehem Records. The two frequently butted heads as Nina insisted on choosing her own material. Throughout her entire life, if you can say anything about Nina Simone, is that she knew what she wanted, and that's what she did. She was her own person to the end of her life. She started recording her own music in the late 50s under that Bethlehem label and released her first album in 1957, the song I Loves You, Porgy. A cover of the song from the musical Porgy and Bess became a top 20 hit. What's really cool, if you watch the documentary that's on Netflix, she talks about that song, I Loves You, Porgy, was not pushed to be a single. It was not advertised as being a single.
Right.
They released the album and it became a single by itself.
Wow.
That's how good it was. It got to number 2. On the Billboard charts.
Wow. Dang.
She and Sid Nathan continued to have disagreements, especially once she found out that he had signed away all the royalties to her music, right? Without talking to her. And so in 1959, she said goodbye, and she went and signed another deal with a company called Copix Records instead.
Okay.
And it's here where she started producing live records because she was such a powerful live performer. It said once she sat in front of a piano, all of her other problems just went away. She could just be Nina on the piano.
I relate to that.
So she released many albums from the 1950s, the late 1950s into the early 70s, including The Amazing Nina Simone, Nina Simone Sings Ellington, Wild as the Wind, and Silk and Soul. She also covered famous songs like The Times They Are Changin' by Bob Dylan and Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles.
Ooh, nice.
So her mix of styles as well as her classical training defied the standard definitions at the time. It's said in the documentary, they talk about how people felt her being able to bring things out of songs that no one else at the time was able to do. She was able to convey messages and emotions.
Right.
Unlike anyone else living at the time, almost like what Adele does today.
Mm.
She was proclaimed to be the high priestess of soul, but she hated that nickname, apparently. Mm. And she wrote in her autobiography later, if I had to be called something, it should have been a folk singer because there was more folk and blues than jazz in my playing.
Mm.
In 1964, Nina left Copix and then signs a deal with Philips, which also coincided with a shift in the themes of her music. This is around the time when the civil rights movement is really getting going. And Nina Simone really, really wanted to become a part of the movement as a whole. And so actually she started doing things that started hurting her career. So she started making songs with lyrics and other themes that did not necessarily ingratiate herself.
So Nina Simone became the first rap artist.
Well, not
I mean,
rap,
no, I know it's not rap, but songs with messages.
Oh, true. Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, if you want to say in the same like vein where she was using
the
her
same
music,
idea of using your music to
as for a
speak
cause.
About and for a social cause.
Exactly. So after Medgar Evers was assassinated and the Birmingham church bombing happened, which killed four young African-American girls.
Right.
She wrote the song Mississippi Goddamn, which again, in this documentary, if you watch it, it's all like there's this one guy saying we were all thinking it. Nina Simone was just the one who said it. When she released it, a Carolina radio station, in fact, multiple radio stations in the Carolinas and around, they didn't just refuse to play it. They returned the box of records smashed to Nina Simone. So this is really when she starts conveying explicitly political messages. She wrote a song called The Four Women, which chronicled the complex histories of a quartet of African-American figures and young, gifted, and black, which was inspired by playwright and friend Lorraine Hansberry and became a popular anthem. By the mid-60s, Nina Simone had become one of the prominent voices of the civil rights movement. After the assassination of Martin Luther King, her bassist Greg Taylor wrote the song Why, The King of Love is Dead, and Simone and her band played it at the Westbury Music Festival. It is a heartbreaking tribute. She said about the change in her music that love songs had been her principal inspiration, but there was a love that superseded that to bring her people together and secure their rights. She said, I stopped singing love songs and started singing protest songs because protest songs were needed. You can be a complete politician through music. I have become more militant because the time is right.
Mm.
There's another quote that I put on my Facebook, but I'll put it on the Bitchery Facebook as well, where she said, I choose to reflect the times and the situations in which I find myself. That, to me, is my duty. And at this crucial time in our lives, when everything is so desperate, when every day is a matter of survival, I don't think you can help but be involved. Young people, black and white, know this, and so that's why they're so involved in politics. We will shape and mold this country, or it will not be molded and shaped anymore. So I don't think you have a choice. How can you be an artist and not reflect the times?
Ooh, I right? like it.
Don't you just feel that like yeah. in your soul, at the bottom yes. of your stomach? So during this time, she started traveling all over the world because she had such a big voice in the United States. She started getting an international presence as well. Mm-hmm. The songs I Put a Spell on You, To Love Somebody, and Ain't Got No, I Got Life, Do What You Gotta Do became hits in England as well. In 1964, she put out a single called Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which was a hit in England, but didn't fare very well in the United States again because...
Right.
Right. And then 1 year later, the band The Animals did a pop cover of that same song and put it on the charts in both countries.
Mm.
Yeah. So as the 1960s ended, she left her husband at the time, just left, took off her wedding ring and put it on the counter and left away. Apparently, she was not in the best marriage life. Right. Her husband is the reason why she was so successful. He kind of became her manager mm-hmm. over the time. He was a police officer who quit to kind of be her manager. And he really was not very good to her in their personal life, even though he created her career almost.
Right.
He really is the one who got her name out and everything that. And so she left and kind of went to travel the world. She became tired of the American music scene and the racial politics.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing is that she started refusing to pay her income taxes as a protest against the U.S. involvement in Vietnam War.
Ooh.
But also she was not very happy with America at the time.
Right.
So I think just all of that put together, plus the fact that she had sacrificed pretty much everything she had in terms of her artistic
right.
and her career to become a political icon
right.
of the civil rights movement. So once that started dying down, the whole movement
right.
between the 1960s and then by the end, by 1991, she ends up going between Liberia, Switzerland, England, Barbados, and then finally she settles down in the 90s, very early 90s, in the south of France. And in that time, some other stuff happens to her. She goes...
Okay, got it.
She gets arrested for not paying her taxes in the 70s. Okay. She really kind of goes on a little spiral. They find out later that she gets diagnosed with manic depression. And also with bipolar disorder, which kind of explains a lot of
right.
what she was going through and also explains her music to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Once she kind of comes out of this slump, she has a career spike in the 80s when her song My Baby Just Cares For Me was used in a Chanel No. 5 commercial in the UK and became a top 10 hit in Britain. And then she had a biography come out, an autobiography, I Put a Spell on You, which was published in 1991. And then her next and final record was released in 1993. It was called A Single Woman. In 1995, Nina fired a gun at one of her neighbors during an argument and was then later diagnosed with bipolar disorder, like I talked about a second ago.
Wow.
She was given a suspended 8-month jail term, and she continued to perform live through the summer of 2002 when she discovered that she had breast cancer. Nina Simone died at the age of 70 on April 21st, 2003 at her home in Carry-le-Rue, France.
Mm-hmm.
A few days before her death, Nina received an honorary degree from Curtis Institute in Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
The same school that had rejected her in 1953.
That's awesome.
In the last decade of her life, Nina came back. She sold over 1 million CDs, making her global catalog a bestseller. And over the course of her life, she recorded 40 original albums.
Holy mackerel.
Isn't that amazing? It's an amazing amount of work. It's an amazing body of work.
40 albums?
40 different albums.
That's like 400 songs.
Okay, so here's some of the performers that have listed her as being an inspiration. Joni Mitchell.
Yes.
Laura Nyro. Lauryn Hill. And Aretha Franklin.
Yes. Go Queen.
So that's Nina Simone. She was a firebrand. She knew what she wanted. She knew who she was. But she had some demons as well.
All the good artists do.
Exactly.
The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can download a free book and start a free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
This week, I am going to recommend a book that I hadn't thought about in a while, but is a great one.
Uh-huh.
It's called Sarah, Plain and Tall. It's by Patricia McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kid's book, kind of. It's in the same vein as sort of Anne of Green Gables and Caddy Woodlawn and...
Oh. Okay.
Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
It's just a great classic book.
Fantastic.
Sarah, Plain and Tall.
A nice, good read.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And you can get that book and thousands of others.
Millions of others.
Millions of others at audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening. Can you do me a quick favor right now before this episode is even over? Take a look at where you're listening to it, be it iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, Google Play. Just take 1 second and give us a rating or leave us a quick review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thanks.
All right, so today in herstory.
Yeah, always. I'm ready.
All right. So May 7th, 1429, Joan of Arc leads the final charge, ending the siege of Orléans, reportedly pulling an arrow from her own shoulder. This marked the turning point in the Hundred Year War.
Get it, queen.
For the full story of Joan of Arc, check out her episode.
On May 8th, 1914, the second Sunday in May, it's officially designated Mother's Day by Congress. That's today.
That is today. So
it was yesterday. Don't we release on Mondays?
Oh, yeah. That was yesterday.
Love you, Mom.
Love you, Mom. Aww. And then on May 12th, 1743, Maria Theresa of Austria is crowned the Queen of Bohemia.
Ooh, Queen of Bohemia. I want to be Queen of Bohemia.
I know, I do too.
That's an amazing title.
That really is. Queen of Bohemia.
I think if I ever have to enter some sort of beauty contest, mm-hmm. I'm just going to say, just mark me down as Queen of Bohemia. Thank you.
First and last name, Queen, middle name of last name, Bohemia.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So like, our term of the week, we're going to be talking about the hashtag not all men.
Yes, which I think is stupid, but you talk about it first.
Well, here's what I would say.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I have so much to say.
We'll just start and we'll see where
it goes. I'm just going to go on a rant, okay. And I'm not going to apologize for it because good. I have thoughts. There is a fantastic video series that David Schwimmer just put out. It's called That's Harassment or That's Sexism. I was so uncomfortable watching it. I only watched two. There's six of them and I could only watch two. And I was
like, it was good or it was.
It was so good, but so realistic and uncomfortable. Yeah, it's called That's Harassment.
Yeah, That's Harassment.
And because it just goes into these things that some men might not realize that's harassment, but they film them kind of documentary style. So you're like looking in through a window watching it. So
do the guys already know that they're being.
Yes. It's all actors.
Oh, okay.
It's all actors.
Okay.
But yeah, it's staged in a way that you're just kind of watching it. And me as a woman, I'm just like, I know what's going to happen and I want to vomit.
Yeah.
Because it's really well done. It's really, really well done to the point that I didn't watch the rest of them because I know what's harassment. And the point that he's trying to make with these videos is just that it's kind of harassment is all around you.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say that. The point, too, is that there are some people who may not realize what is harassment or what can be considered harassment.
Right.
So I think a lot of the people or a lot of the men who are upset and are saying, you know, hashtag not all men, it's not all of us. Yes, you are correct. There are some amazing allies and some amazing men.
Absolutely.
Out there. But I think it was a Tumblr post that put it best.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to be listening to our podcast, let us know. And it said, the thing that you have to realize is that it's not the fact that every man is out to hurt someone or harass someone or rape someone.
Right.
So it's not about it being not all men. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that all women have experienced sexual harassment or been raped or dealt with an abusive relationship or whatever you may have. So it's not that it's not all men. It's hashtag all women have experienced something like this from the opposite sex.
Saying hashtag not all men or just saying not all men is a way of silencing the conversation. It's saying, look, this doesn't personally affect me and it's not something that I do. So I don't want to have the conversation. But you literally, if you are a man, it doesn't make you part of the problem, but it does give you an opening to be part of the solution.
Yes. It's kind of like saying hashtag not all white people, which doesn't really fly.
Well, it's like saying all lives matter instead of Black Lives Matter. It's the answer to a question that really no one's asking.
Right.
By saying not all men, yes, it seems obvious. It's you're defending yourself saying, no, I don't do those things. But at the same time, like, this argument is not about you. It's not about the things that you're doing. It's not a read on what you're doing or not doing in your personal life. It is literally, this is a thing that happens. It is verifiable. There are enough instances that have been documented. And so it is a problem that's happening.
Right.
And saying not all men just dismisses that problem.
Right. It's not me. So therefore, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But it does, because if it's not you, then fantastic. Please pass that along to your other male friends.
Exactly.
Because this is a thing that I do, whether I'm running early in the morning or I'm walking by myself, even in bright daylight. If I'm the only person on the sidewalk and there is a man coming towards me, honestly, it does not matter his skin color at all. Right. He could be Black. He could be white. He could be Indian. He could be dressed whatever in a fish color, costume.
Exactly, yeah.
It doesn't matter. He could be any age as well. It doesn't really matter. I am already on high alert.
Yeah, sure.
Just because you are a man. And I'm not going to, you know, apologize for that either. It doesn't matter. I am already in a situation that could turn out badly for me. And yes, it's not all men, but it does happen.
Right.
And we as women are also told almost every day of our lives that it happens and to be on alert and to take self-defense classes. Can we just have don't rape people classes?
That really is what it is. It's by saying not all men, it puts the onus on the woman to figure out the solution by themselves. And if you really, we've talked about this before when we talked about the term ally. Being an ally is being aware of a situation that you yourself do not have a stake in terms of being the person who is oppressed, but recognizing that there is a problem and helping to change the culture. So if not all men is a phrase that you want to use, it should never be directed to a woman. It should be directed to another man saying, hey, you just did something that helps perpetuate a culture that makes my friends, my relatives, and all women in general feel unsafe and uncomfortable. So if you want to use the phrase, not all men,
Use it in that way
as a way to help change the culture. Because really, until the culture itself has changed, not all men does not make sense.
This PSA brought to you by Ursula Major Productions. But it's so true.
Yeah.
This is actually a great lead-in kind of to our cause this week in a weird backhanded way. I was going to talk about woofing. It's WWOOF. It's Worldwide Organic Living and Learning Worldwide on Organic Farms. Somehow the letters make sense, I promise. But women are often told not to travel by themselves because it's dangerous because of men.
Right.
I have traveled by myself. I've walked around London by myself. It's all fine if you're smart. But again, it's perpetuating that culture where then if I am walking in London by myself and I see someone coming towards me, I'm already on high alert.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
WOOF stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms.
And it's awesome. And it's basically, it's travel volunteerism. You can choose a location and you can go live and work on an organic farm and help out. And so you're traveling and you're seeing the world, but you're also volunteering your time and really getting immersed in a culture. You're living that culture.
So you're helping on a farm?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
On an organic farm for however long you want?
I think so.
Yeah. Cool.
It's very always cool. Sounded super cool to me. I've always wanted to do it. So you can find out more about it.
At WOOF International. Again, that's WWOOFinternational.org.
Check it out.
Check it out. The Bitry of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at UMPBOH. On Facebook, just search The Bitry of History. We just cracked 4,000 followers on the Facebook page.
Oh my goodness.
Thank you so much. We started season 2 with 1,200.
Whoa, go team go.
Go team go.
Our team is amazing. I want to give a special shout out to our production and research team. That's Jeanette,
Kim,
Stephanie,
Ashley,
Dan,
Steph,
Sydney,
and Olivia. Thank you so much, team. Y'all are doing fantastic work.
Go queens, go.
Yes, ma'ams. And sir, Dan's in there.
Dan can be a queen for this.
That's true.
Men can be queens if they want.
Yes. ungender the world.
If you guys are really digging this podcast, check out the Patreon. You can get awesome bloopers, deleted scenes. You know that's the best part of any DVD special. That's patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Yes, ma'am. And as always,
bitches get stuff done.